I will start with a long citation from Evliya Çelebi himself. That actually is where I could stop simply and just turn it over, because it is the passage that's been in my mind for years and keeps me going into different avenues with different questions and looking for answers for really rather big questions that I will only touch upon here today. I mean, both with respect to the questions and the answers of that level, I will give you a summary account and a little bit of a blueprint as to what I'm doing in thinking about this fascinating sets of passages from Evliya Çelebi. So now we're going to... it's a bit physically uncomfortable today, but don't worry, I'll ease into it. And my papers, I always have, you know, lots of wads of paper that gives me a sense of security. And when I don't have them right nearby, it's an odd feeling. So please excuse me. Here, Evliya Çelebi. He is... As some of you know, this is volume 7, and Evliya Çelebi is in the Caucasus Mountains among the Circassians. With his hosts from Crimea, he has left, as he wanted to do for a long time, to visit that end of the world, or that part of the world, at the very northern end of the Elburz Mountains, going from the south-central Caspian Sea to the Caucasus, and even beyond it now, Evliya. But with Elburz Mountain, I just have a couple of images quickly put together of the sort of thing that Evliya, the first one was obviously a very recent photograph. These are the kinds of images, not exactly the same ones, and not in fact Ottoman images, but Evliya would have seen manuscripts, did see manuscripts of other types of provenance, Indian and Safavid as well. In any case, these are the kinds of depictions which he would have seen before he even went there, about the Elburz Mountain. I'm sorry, not all of you can see. These are stories from the Shahnameh, where the grandfather of Rustam, the father of Zal, right? Thank you. is going to the mountain, and there are all sorts of things which fill people's imagination with respect to that part of the world. And Evliya was certainly familiar with it. And here's another one, again, sorry, you might say, this is the Elburz Mountain as Sam is approaching it. Sam. Okay. Here he is in among the Circassians, beyond even the Elburz Mountain, in areas where few people traveled of this world. But for his mother, of course, who was an Abkhazian slave herself, and his uncle, Melek Ahmet Pasha, from the same background. While this wretched one was in that station, he says, the vampires of the Circassian and the Abkhazian people, namely their witches and magicians, engaged in a battle on the 20th night of Shevval in 1076, which is April 26, 1666. I did not make up to this. It turned almost apocalyptic, with flashes of thunderbolts that filled the dark evening sky with steady fire. The darkness receded as it turned into such a light-filled day that Circassian ladies could have done their fine needlework. We asked the Circassians, we inquired among the Circassians, who said, by God, this happens once a year during the nights of Karakondylos. Mind you, we are within or just at the end of the Karakondylos nights ourselves, which are reckoned in Istanbul calendar, usually as the first 10 nights of the new year, or maybe the 10 nights from after the 24th of December onwards. But I'm not going to impose a calendar on the Karakondylos. They can choose their own dates and they can be flexible, but these nights are known as the Karakondylos Geceleri, or the word Karakondylos coming from Greek Karikanzari. So, over there in April, Karakondylos Geceleri,
Our Circassian vampires and the Acasian ones fly into the sky and engage in a mighty battle. Do go out and enjoy the spectacle without fear, his host said. It turns out, this is Elias still, it turns out that Ogur is the name they give to certain magic-wielding witches. Clearly, he expected his audience not to know the word, not in that sense anyway. 70 or 80 of us, he continues, went out with our weapons for a smooth spectacle. What we saw was that from beyond the vampire mountain, Abkhazian magicians came flying over the mountain, seated on huge unrooted trees and jars and vessels and cartwheels and oven sticks and many other types of objects. Thereupon, from within the Habesh mountain, our Circassians flew off. Several hundred of them, our Circassians, he's holding sides. This is relevant. Several hundred of them, with hair blowing in the wind, this is my favorite, with teeth protruding like those of elephants, with streams of fire like shipmasts released into the sky from their eyes and noses and ears and mouths, with each one riding on the cadaver of a horse or an ox or a camel, or fishing boats carved of wood, and wielding a snake or a dragon or some rope or the head of a horse or a camel, Abkhazian magicians and Circassian vampires flying like this attacked each other in the sky. And the witches of those two people engaged in such warfare that we were filled with awe from the shrieks and painful cries that deafened our ears. For a full 6 hours, they maintained their fight. Pieces of felt, mats, wooden sticks started falling on us. Thereafter, dead men and horses and camels did. And then, broken pieces of jars and oven cleaning brooms and woolen overcoats and sheepskin rugs and chalk. As these kept falling, our horses, who were out there, went into wailing and crying. And since large bursts of fire also came down from the sky, many of our horses freed themselves, and we barely contained them. And then, 7 Circassian vampires and 7 Abkhazian witches. This, I guess, is like the national squad. The most elect ones. 7 Circassian vampires and 7 Abkhazian witches. Do not mind the change of vocabulary about vampires and witches so much. He uses them interchangeably on occasion, though there may be some system to it that I've not yet been able to understand. Anyway, so 7 and 7 on each side wrapped themselves around each other, stuck their heads under the necks of the others, and fell down to earth. Some Circassians ran over and separated them from each other. But meanwhile, an Abkhazian vampire had drunk the blood of 2 Circassian vampires who were dead. But 5 of them were alive. 5 of the 7 Abkhazian witches lifted themselves up and went skyward again. Circassians burnt the other 2 Abkhazian witches who had sucked the blood of the Circassian vampires. So the score is 2-2. Thus we watched the spectacle of the vampires of the 2 peoples until the crowing of the roosters. Such battle and warfare took place in the high sky that it can be neither interpreted by word nor written down by pen. From the cries and shrieks and the wailing and the tempest of that night, as well as from the fear and the awe that we experienced, not a moment of the rest of sleep comforted our eyes. As all the witches dispersed and disappeared after the crowing of the roosters, a thunderous noise was heard and huge things started falling down from the sky to the earth, the wood, and the mountain. At dawn, a few well-armed comrades and I went to the ground under the very sky of the battle. We found dead horses and donkeys and pigs, and drums and barrels and kneading troughs, oven cloths with sticks, Sanglian elephants, Eli Mangurusi, some of you may know, special type, cadavers of human beings taken out of their graves, cups and pots and pans and mats and snakes and centipedes and goats and sheep and bears. The grass that covered the soil had turned invisible due to hundreds of thousands of things of this sort. There were plenty of bodies of dead slaves with chains on their feet and bloated cadavers of animals. In short, I used to be a skeptic of such tales. But this was witnessed by thousands of soldiers in our company who now remained in perplexity. Among them, there were many, among the Circassians, there were many who had previously experienced this. But even the Circassian folks swore that for 40 or 50 years they had not seen such a crowded battle of the vampires. 5 or 10 of them perhaps fought each other on earth with carts and pots and occasionally took to the sky, but that was that. This year, however, last night, was a wondrous spectacle. Plague does not occur in these lands. He moves to another level of discourse after the eyewitness account. Plague does not occur in these lands. Whether a man is ill or not, on the nights of Karakonjalos, vampires suck the blood of the person they choose, ill or well, and kill that person. The vampire is thus released of his affliction. I guess it means temporarily, but it's not clear. But the signs of his vampirehood remain in his eyes. There are elderly Circassian men with pedigree and of the appearance of physician healers who recognize witches and magicians. When there is a death, those of his or her household who survive the dead person pay money to these healers to go to the graves of vampires previously deceased, and if they find that the soil is messy, namely that the vampire has gone out of his grave the previous night, people gather there, dig up the burial, and they see his or her eyes have turned into a blood-filled vessel. His face is all red for having drunk human blood. They know this is a vampire. They immediately take the corpse of the damned vampire and stick a hawthorn stake into his belly, all the way to the ground. Hawthorn Bertland, Bert de Land. Evely, I wouldn't miss an opportunity to spell it so that you read it right. Not with a test. So, stick a hawthorn stake into his belly all the way to the ground. By the order of God Almighty, the vampire's magic becomes annulled. And the man whose blood is sucked comes back to life by the order of God. If the poor dead has nobody to find a vampire recognizer or a vampire expert, that person whose blood is sucked remains dead. Kimsesis is the word he uses. Kimsesis is a more general concept that would be known to some of you. And God is often referred to as Kimsesis Lakimsesis, the one who looks after the ones who don't have anyone to look after. I summarize a bit here. Some are not satisfied with the stake and also burn the corpse. In other words, he gives this lengthy description of the way one deals with a vampire. And he ends up by saying, those corpses never decompose by the wisdom of God. Another layer of discourse. When a vampire goes about his life, nobody knows about him. But when the hour strikes and he goes rabid, kudurduğunda, he finds a man or his son sleeping or naked in some water. These are the true vulnerable positions, circumstances. He embraces that man and sucks his blood from below his ear and lets go. Day by day, that person becomes unwell and informs his relatives saying, yo, help, a vampire has taken me and sucked blood out of my ear. Bremedet. Now, when this person is confined for 3 days, the vampire manifests himself day by day and says, I am the one who sucked the blood of so-and-so. Here behind my ear is his blood. And I did it so that my body does not decompose when I'm buried next to my vampire ancestors and so that I can come back to life for a few more times, and so that I can do battle in the sky, and so that I live long. Everyone consents then to drive a hawthorn stake into his belly. And if one smears vampire blood on the face of the one whose blood is sucked, by the will of God Almighty, he is cured and the vampire is burned. These vampiric magicians are of another species. Out of fear of mixing with them, the Circassian folks do not readily intermarry with even the choicest of people. In some, in this land of Circassia, there is no plague, but vampire trouble is more serious than the mighty plague. It is likely to happen in many of the lands of Muscovy and Cossacks and Poland and Czechia. May God protect us from that evil. The lands of Rule, on the other hand, have the Karakonjalos. Then Evliya moves to relating that there is something peculiar about the religion of the Circassians, which is relevant for my larger concerns, but I'll be brief here. He says, if you call them infidel, from this account, he moves to speaking about the religiosity of the Circassians, and he says, if you call them infidel, they give you no mercy but kill you. They would never accept that term. And they say, La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. But they devour fat pigs with their tails, and they do not fast or pray. This in-betweenness, I believe, is an important matter about vampire lore at large. And here Evliya Çelebi himself moves to Circassians in-between religions, as he understands, or religiosity and irreligiosity, religiosity and infidelity, as he understands them, as Evliya understands them, as soon as he finishes with the account of vampirism. This is not the first mention of obur. This is the word, right? Obur is Evliya's word for vampire, which he felt he had to explain to his Istanbul audiences. And in another volume, in volume 6, among the Tatars again, he writes, in the Tatar language, obur is the name given to witches, magic-wielding women, and those who come back too, while in the grave. Lisan Tatar'da, obur, caduya ve sihirbaz avrata ve mezarda dirilene derler. Okay. This account in Circassia is not the first time Evliya mentions obur in his travel book. I am sure it is known to some of you here in this neighborhood that Cihangir was once the abode of various aliens brought here by Alizade. Oh yes, Cihangirliler, they must know. Again, I'm going to give you a long citation from Evliya. This is from volume 1. This is the history of Istanbul and the opening of the Channel of the Bosphorus. In the times of the Christians, there was a monastery within a woods in Tophane. Ormanistan is the word. In Tophane, what we now know as the Mosque of Cihangir is built on the grounds of that world-viewing hermitage. Once a year, the infidels would visit it in the name of Hagia Alexandra, Holy Alexander. When the two-horned Alexander finished building the wall of Gog, over there, Gog and Magog, Alexander built his wall, when he finished, he brought several ghouls, and several black bees, and magic-wielding oburs, sahare oburlar, the word beginning, from the mountain of Elburz in the Circassian province, after the wall, that's where the wall is, more or less, north of the Caspian Sea, and Alexander comes back with bees and ghouls and magic-wielding ogres. And magician women, Sehere Avretler, from the mountains of Sache in Abkhazian lands. He brings them to Constantinople, which is a Macedonian city. So Alexander is Macedon, Istanbul is Macedon. He imprisoned them, after he brought them here, he imprisoned them in a huge cave in Tophane, binding their heads, hands, and legs tightly with strong fibers of date trees. By the order of God, they could not move at all due to the strength of these charmed ropes. Those who made their annual visit to the Alexander cloister here in Cihangir would watch the ghouls, the thieves, and the magicians. When the 40 days of deep winter arrived, Zemheri, Erbain, also he uses the word Erbain. When the 40 days of deep winter arrive with Alexander's leave, the above-mentioned magicians embark on copper boats constructed with a protective charm and roam the White and the Black Sea without a captain, sliding like an invisible leaf. Sliding. He uses the J word a lot, and in another passage, this is important and relevant for my purposes, he says that the devil prefers three sounds, kef, fe,
and jet. And you can imagine. So Brigildeur is one of the words he uses in describing the battles of the vampires that I used in translation. So Brigildeurek, they go like an invisible leaf on the White Sea and the Black Sea before there's a Bosphorus. And they protect Macedonia, namely the city of Constantine. After 40 days, they return to Topane, tie down their boats, and the magicians, this is in the past, of course, and the magicians were imprisoned again. Alexander made the thieves and the ghouls to bore through the mountains and open the channel of the Black Sea, namely the Bosphorus. The thieves and the ghouls were flushed into the water at that site, after the opening, and all the magicians died. Their copper boats remained in Topane until the time that Yezid bin Muawiyah came to conquer Istanbul, when Muslim warriors found pieces of those copper vessels and plundered them. This is confirmed by multiple reports. Tevatürle muhakkaktır. Now, direction. Okay. We don't have the word obur, but before I move on, the word vampir, I'm not going to go into it, but the word vampir definitely comes from ufir, which comes from obur. I don't think there's any doubt on this among linguists. And the word obur does not survive in the same sense in modern Turkish, though the meaning of gluttonous is not that far, and it's also onomatopoeically inspired to suck into, to go hapur hapur, which is also used in Turkey in an onomatopoeic fashion. But another word that we still use is from the same root, which should give you a good sense as to the depth of that root, which survives in some Inner Asian Turkic languages, or it did until recently. I have seen several accounts of 19th century travelers who have op mak, op as the root, in the sense of sucking, saugen. And presumably, öpmek is also from the same. No, honestly. So, the gist of the vampire is match. Obruk is something that is sucked. Oburuk, oburulmuş olan. That, sorry. It's that kind of topic. If you allow me. I'll show you some of these obruks. And in the... Yes. And this happens all of a sudden. It's a rather scary thing. Those who live in the Konya Karaman region may have seen some or heard of stories. In the news, I see at least once a year there is one obruk emerging, some small, some larger. It's a geologists know a lot about this, and they draw pictures like this, cross sections of obruks and how they happen. In Al-Harawi's account of his Anatolian route in the 12th century, which is one of the earliest accounts of post-Manzikert Anatolia in an Islamic language, Al-Harawi describes an obruk which was inhabited and filled with, in the Konya region, filled near the Salt Lake, he says, filled with precious objects. This is the famous Cennet Cehennem obrukları in Mersin, Silifke area. It's only by mistake that it's in reverse, but I did not bother. Okay. Now comes this wretched one. And I'm done with every other kind, and I'm going to give you a few words about my own thinking on this and vampire lord such. Evliya Çelebi's account comes, first of all, we should note that it comes at the beginning more or less of an outpour of reports about vampirism from many parts of
especially but not only, Eastern, Southeastern, and South Central Europe, by many different authors from many different careers. So he is writing, he's giving us the account that I just read to you at length in translation. Contemporaneously with the increasing visibility of vampirism in written sources, at least there. Why the outpour, of course, is the first question that comes to mind. Is it simply that there are more cases? Or is it an intensification of some sort? Not necessarily quantitative, but an intensification. Is it simply a matter of more visibility somehow? Simply that there is more writing on such things. All of these are possibilities, and please don't expect an answer. I don't know yet. But certain things do happen around this time. I will return to this question which has been bugging me for years. But as we labor with such questions, we also need to, historians always should, try and chart their facts as well. When and where exactly? As we think about it, not before or after, but as we do that thinking. So from the mid to late 17th century, from that time frame of a few decades onwards, we have an outpouring of reports about vampirism. And then, beginning early in the 18th century, we have several well-known Enlightenment authors or physicians writing about vampirism and debating and often simply presenting counter-arguments with respect to the possibility of such a thing. During the 18th century, there's much written in a more philosophical vein, not to mention the medical reports and various law cases in front of the law courts regarding vampirism, from mostly that geography. That area gave us rather accurately. Remember, Moscow, said Muscovy, the lands of the Cossacks. The Ottomans, until the 19th century, were rather careful in distinguishing Rus, not generalizing it and making it into a term, as we do most nowadays with regard to the larger Russian sphere. In any case, Muscovy, Cossacks, Czechia, Poland, he said. Did not mention the Balkans, but obviously the cases are extended in that region, as we know. From the late 17th century onwards, there are many instances. And I don't have a clock or anything that. Okay. There are several very interesting epidemics, they are called sometimes. These kinds of outpourings from the 1720s and 1730s. And then again, there's another major outpouring in the 1820s and 1830s. But during the 18th century, unlike the earliest instances that are mostly about South Central, Central and Eastern Europe, during the 18th century, we have copious reports from the Ottoman Balkans. There are also a few from the 17th century, but the geography seems to, in terms of our written reports, seems to be shifting somewhat.
Now we can go to that later.
After the Enlightenment authors, mostly physicians and philosophers, as I said, there came another outpouring in the early 19th century that coincided with the romantic reaction to the 18th century Enlightenment rationalizing kinds of reports and counter-arguments with respect to vampirism. So in the 1820s and 1830s, we have this very interesting phenomenon of, on the one hand, several outbursts, several epidemics of vampirism, mostly in the Balkans, and its adoption into high literature for the first time, or what would eventually become literature adopted by educated and learned people, beginning with the folks around Lord Byron's circle, of course, Lord Byron himself mentioning vampires in his famous The Jungle, written in the 1820s.
I could cite it
to you, but my papers, see, that's why I'm uncomfortable.
I need my papers.
But first on earth, as vampire sent, thy corse shall from its tomb be rent, then ghastly haunt thy native place, and suck the blood of all thy race. He actually pushes all the buttons here, and I started my line of thinking based on Lord Byron's vocabulary and some of the other works of this 19th century European literature, where vampirism appears in the same light as native place, blood of race, etc., etc. Namely, it is turning into a metaphor whereby one starts to negotiate national identity, civilizational belonging, racial identity, and whatnot. This, in the 1820s, for the first time, with Dr. Polidori in the circle of Lord Byron, they were together. You know this film by Ken Russell? Gothic. Some of you do, I'm sure, right? He tells the story of that circle, and it's a fascinating film. Dr. Polidori, Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and several friends are together. And out of that circle come the classics of 19th century Gothic literature and beyond. In any case, so in terms of outbursts of vampirism, this comes at the very end, 1820s and 30s, though there are still some instances known from later in the 19th century all the way into the early 20th century, and even in the late 20th and early 21st century, there are some recorded incidents of belief in vampirism among, for instance, emigres of former Yugoslavia in Scandinavia. I read a fascinating report, maybe because the nights are so dark, about former Yugoslavian emigre workers and their families in Norway who are still taking paying very serious attention to the count. Just when the vampire lore was being worked into modern European literature, where it will flourish and turn into a universally recognized phenomenon by the end of the 20th century, through Bram Stoker above all, there occurred those several epidemics that I mentioned, including some very interesting ones that I will mention again in the Ottoman world. Thereafter, both the Enlightenment view and the Romantic view, maybe even reinforcing one another in an odd way, were elaborated in numerous works of literature and cinema to turn vampirism into one of the most fecund metaphors of our time. It works, as we all know, as a very complex metaphor to negotiate many issues. It has been doing that since the 19th century, at least. I'll just list a few that seem significant to me. Ancient or timeless evil versus modern technology. Return of the repressed, staying power of the alien, the marginal, the grotesque, undying love, anxieties about blood, ancestry, purity, belonging, anxieties about one's own death, neglect of filial duties, bizarre and violent aspects of eroticism, and many other things. But to look at vampire lore itself, how ancient is the vampire lore as we know it? The general consensus is that it is the coming together of various elements, some of them very ancient indeed, in the early modern era. Gabor Planichai, a Hungarian historian, has referred to this as the decline of witches and the rise of vampires, something that took place during the 17th and 18th centuries in different parts of the European geography, including the eastern and southern ends of it. The decline of witches and the rise of vampires. If so, we should also note the changing geography of these beliefs. Witchcraft was more widespread and more early on in Western and Central Europe. Not so much even in Holland or the British Isles ever. Its final flourish in the 17th century was mostly in the periphery, in Hungary, in New England, in Scandinavia. As it was receding in from the say mid-17th century onwards or earlier in Western and Central Europe, as it was receding, it was still going very strong, and in fact stronger in some other parts of the world that are generally treated as the periphery. So that's one bit of the geography. Its final flourish in that periphery occurred with an overlap at first with stories of witchcraft, but eventually emerged with, namely vampirism, eventually emerged with its distinct characteristics, even though at first there was this nebulous, blurred area between vampirism and witchcraft. And the area, again, seems to fall into line with the general attitude of the kinds of reports that we have from circa mid-17th century. From the late 17th century onwards, especially with medical reports, vampirism is going to have its distinct identity and its own life. Klanichai feels that it is a synthesis of five different sets of magical beliefs, all of them rather ancient, but them coming together as a synthesis is peculiar to this early modern era. Remember my question about why this outburst, why then? We obviously need to put some time on this. Okay. Gabor Klanichai feels that it is a synthesis of various traits from five different sets of magical beliefs. The revenants, however one pronounces it, those who come back. The alt-like nightly pressing spirits, which is rather like the albastikarısı of Turkish folklore. I don't have time to go into this, but it's really fascinating to think of these. The blood-sucking sticks of antiquity. Those witches from Slavic and Balkan territories who were said to persist in harmful activities after their deaths. And finally, the werewolf, a person capable of adopting the form of a wolf in order to attack and devour humans. There are well-attested cases of all of these things, some of them from antiquity, some of them copiously in the medieval era, but them coming together in a particular form with an added layer, especially having to do with uses of blood that makes the vampire story so distinct, is a matter, it seems, of the early modern era. The first clear vampire case, in fact, is from Silesia and in 1591. Thereafter, there are a few cases reported in the early 17th century, 1618 in Bohemia, 1624 in Cracovia. From the mid-17th century onwards, the Balkans become the place where we have the majority, the overwhelming majority of reports. Balkans, though, including the very boundary with the Habsburg world. The in-betweenness is something I want to underline. Perhaps you already sensed it. And of course, there are different words. The Greek word "brikulakas" is more common in the Greek-speaking parts of the empire. And they don't always do the very same thing, but in general, the tendency is to see them as part of the vampire lore. Perhaps the most it gets very hard. The most sensationalizing reporting came in the 1720s with a particular case that eventually made it to this book, and I'll read it. I think I have it printed out. Can anyone read it? This book at the very title underlines the fact that it is at the border of the Turkish or European Turkey, this is of course the vocabulary of Europeans of the time, not necessarily our vocabulary, borders of European Turkey and Christendom. This word is, this dichotomy is very common in 17th century European travel books where one reads, it's not the only kind of vocabulary, but it is very common where one reads, I left the lands of European Turkey, I left the lands of Turkey and entered Christendom, or vice versa. In any case, so if this underlines the fact that this is happening at the grand center borders where Serbian and Hungarian, of course, lands were changing hands, moving this way and that way. That very sensational case of the 1720s involved a Serbian soldier, who came from Medveđa, a village near Belgrade, and complained of being tormented by a Turkish vampire, another soldier, he said. And this became, for various reasons, because this is a time when the court in Vienna and Prague wants to do something about what they call superstitions. At first they are interested mostly in suppressing witchcraft beliefs. But as people go out to the field, they find more of vampirism than of witchcraft. Because this is now the early 18th century, as I said, this is the decline of witches and the rise of vampires. So they find this, and they have to deal with it. They write reports, they have medical discussions, especially Van Swieten, which I think is the one who inspired the name Van Helsing. Van Swieten is one of the two very famous Dutch physicians of the 18th century. Boerhaave was his teacher and mentor. I'm mentioning this with a few sentences because Boerhaave was translated into Turkish, Ottoman Turkish, by Hekimbaşı Abdülhatip Sufi Paşa. And Hekimbaşı Abdülhatip Sufi Paşa mentions Boerhaave's novice student, Van Swieten, in the introduction, saying these are the mütehirin, and they don't do medicine as the mütekaddimin, and these are the modern ones, and they don't do medicine as the ancients did. With a positive spin on this. That's why he feels it's worth translating. And Van Swieten single-handedly, perhaps, changed at least the court's attitude, the Habsburg court's attitude toward these beliefs, whereby in 1755, finally, Maria Theresa published a famous promulgation fighting against these kinds of superstitions. 1755 is a turning point in the state attitude toward the lands that are at the borders or just changing hands, have been changing hands since 1683 maybe, between the Ottomans and the Habsburgs, between Turkey and Christendom, however you like to give it. Back to the question I raised earlier. I have to go very quick. I'll be very summary and sketchy. What can I do? Evliya comes at the beginning of an outpouring of reforms. Why, I said? More cases and investigation, more visibility, what is happening? There must be many reasons. But I would like to focus on the one that strikes me as providing a larger contextual framework. On the one hand, there were new understandings of the circulation of blood and of the Eucharist. At the same time, in the late 16th and 17th centuries, there were increasing uses of blood as a metaphor for nationhood, ancestry, and purity. All this at a time when the long-stable Pax Ottomana was facing unprecedented challenges and eventual disintegration towards a new world order, one might say. This was a world of changing borders, or at least emerging new asymmetries of power that destabilized lines of political belonging and religious or civilizational affiliation in Eastern and Southeastern Europe. There's also the struggle between the Enlightenment and foes, let's say, or those the Enlightenment figures consider their foes. And there are new ideas about the circulation of blood, considered a revolution, probably many of you know, in the history of medicine, this is one of the most important revolutionary moments when William Harvey, establishes new facts about the circulation of blood and theorizes and eventually wins the day. One of the first to do a dissertation on the Harveyan system of blood circulation in the University of Padua and then Bologna is Alexander Moro Cordato, who later came to Istanbul to serve as the imperial physician and imperial interpreter and started, of course, the whole line of the Wallachian-Moldavian fanarios. Okay, so changing borders, anxieties about belonging, perhaps in our blood, the Eucharist, I think with Protestantism, again, it would be well known to many of you, but let me just underline, with Protestantism, some were ready to allow for a symbolic interpretation of the Eucharist instead of the actual blood of Jesus Christ. So the metaphor of blood was acquiring another kind of depth through debate and through negotiation of new ideas among Christians. All this might explain the emerging and increasing visibility of the blood sucking undead in the learned circle. You could just say to me, okay, all of this did not necessarily, or how can I know if it did touch the peasant society where belief about vampirism is really where the material comes from for all the other debates and for all the other writing and for all the other negotiations and promulgations and whatnot. What about the folks who lived with the vampires or thought they lived with vampires? Did the dead become more restless in this period in Eastern, Southeastern, and South Central Europe? You know, Peter Brown calls the saints the special dead. It's a very good term. And I think with vampires, we are facing a situation that when people dealt with restless dead, the dead just didn't want to remain dead. They just kept coming back and doing things. Did the dead become more restless in this period? I'm trying to get the image understanding. There's so much to say. You know the discussion about witchcraft. Ultimately, the latest and I think the most sophisticated versions of the discussion on witchcraft revolve around this issue where, okay, we get all that we get from the Inquisition reports about witchcraft, but what about the peasants themselves? And it is there that Carlo Ginzburg's work has generated a good deal of discussion and new types of research, and people are still, of course, divided between these two kinds of foci. So with regard to the peasants, the Enoch understanding, I am even less certain here, but let me note that the Enoch understanding of vampirism was, and continued until the 21st century, even if much diminished, was related to anxieties concerning one's own disease. In other words, members of one's family who may have died unnatural deaths. Suicide was the most common cause of vampirism, they say. Members of one's family who may have died unnatural deaths, or whose burial might have been insufficiently finalized, not proper ritual conducted, not properly attended to, or the dead to whom something may have been owed, not necessarily money. Vampires emerged from among the not-so-peaceful dead, in other words, for the peasant societies, which, from whatever time, I cannot be sure, but at least from the early modern era onwards, generated and sustained these sets of beliefs about vampirism. It is simply a more powerful and a more evocative relative of ghosts whose social functions, namely the social function of beliefs in ghosts, according to E. Thomas, another important figure to cite whenever one speaks about the history of religion in the early modern era, decline of magic, Thomas's book, According to him, the social function of beliefs in ghosts is primarily for enforcement of obligations to ancestors. There are similar things he says about fairies, etc. But ultimately, I think there's a good deal to be taken seriously in this, but these are very directly and strictly functional explanations with which my dear friends here in this audience know I'm never really satisfied. I mean, they're fine. They go a certain way, but, you know, at least they don't explain the forms taken by these beliefs. Function goes from A to B and can take that route in so many ways. Why those forms? If one really wants to think about these kinds of matters, pardon me, fast, is as serious a question as the one that functional explanations suggest they answer. I don't know if the answer, but for now. To the extent that witch and vampire lords express fears of the other, which is another very thing, and this also will be thinking about peasant societies, it is necessary to examine what kind of an other they depict. Where does the danger to our peace and quiet, or to the order of the world, or to the order of our family, or to our own conscience come from? The witch was mostly a woman, mostly a peasant, mostly uneducated, and plus many other things. And complex phenomena like witchcraft craze never limitable, can never be limited to one simple factor of explanation or one simple target. But still, these are clearly, these kinds of people, woman, peasant, uneducated, constitute the majority of the cases of witchcraft that appear in so many court cases and other types of books. The whole idea behind such constructs is their flexibility so that the law can be reshaped and reinterpreted to express new and different concerns and interests. The vampire is an extremely rich, evocative nexus of otherness, and different from that of the ghosts, because it is constructed around the ultimate other, the dead, who are actually undead. How much further into alienness can you go from living humans? Given its structural possibilities, the vampire lore historically is an expression, among other things, of the otherness of those who are at the boundaries of the worlds of Christian Europe and Islamic Middle East, when those boundaries were being destabilized, redrawn, renegotiated. It is not an exclusive interpretation in the sense of being the only possible one, but the construction of the vampire lore can be partly related to these woes about ancestry, to these woes about the purity of blood, to these woes of incorporation into this or that larger thing. This is one of the explanatory frameworks I deal with. How much time do we have? No time, right? How about vampirism as a phenomenon in the Ottoman world? I now would like to speak for another hour on vampirism in the Ottoman world. Okay. To a certain degree, it was a phenomenon. It was, in terms of geography, some of the best known instances, even epidemics, occurred in Ottoman lands or at the borders. So, for instance, let's look at the Let's look at the burial, vampire burials, of which there are many instances archaeologists have been discovering in the late 20th century. And they, of course, archaeologists used to look at earlier stuff and never bother with the late journalistic material. But now that they look more at the medieval and early modern layers of their sites, they've been discovering vampire burials. This one from Poland. You can clearly see the thing on the neck so that they don't rise up. You have to find different measures. Okay, this one from Bulgaria, Suzaport. One of the most famous finds. Just a few years ago it was discovered. And here you see this metal stake on the left where the heart is. That one, together with another one from Bulgaria, again you have a metal stake on the left now lying next to the skull. This one from Ireland, a very surprising. But then vampire lore, remember, came together from various kinds of other layers of stuff, such as different kinds of undead, including ghosts. So different kinds of undead, of which there were many ideas in different societies. Even though they did not necessarily take the form of vampirism, they also have to be dealt with. Here you have the skull cut off, the head cut off, the skull right between the knees, and something stuck in the mouth. So the key, the very dangerous instrument, does not work.
So maybe a case of vampirism too, but as I said, it could be other kinds of undead. This one in Venice. This
one is from Lesbos, Mediglia. The 19th century, probably, the archaeologist says, probably as late as the mid-19th century, and a Muslim there, which is very surprising. All of the others were Christian. And the majority of stories that we know about are Christian community in which these instances are reported.
In Bulgaria, there are more than 100 vampire burials discovered. I hope to visit at least some of them, and then I will report at more length. But this one in Lesbos, I should definitely visit. There is something very odd about this one. This is not the picture on the invitation poster. Look at the one. Okay, which is left, which is right? Somebody who knows more about photography could tell. See, according to this picture, some stake is going through the right side. Right? Right. But wait. Now here the stake is taken off. Here on the left side. Also the positioning of the knee, obviously right and left. There's something really odd happening here.
You know, given the topic, I should maybe not belabor this.
Okay. Never mind. This book cover I wanted to show you. This is the very first edition, 1897.
I love it. And nowadays, the vampire lore has gotten more and more gory, and ideas about marketing have really changed. And there's a very good study to be made of the long 20th century take on vampirism and how it's now serving not just the marketing part of it, but different kinds of anxieties. With AIDS, for instance, it was a really obvious kind of reference in the 1980s in American cinema. In any case, it's a very handsome cover, the first edition. And then, when I speak about vampirism, and often the word, I have to say a few words about Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Third Dracul, right? Those who are readers of vampire stories and vampire lore know well that Vlad Tepes himself really was not at all engaged in any kind of activity that we later identify as vampirism. It is only Bram Stoker who brought the two together. Vlad was well known as a rather cruel type of person. There are more positive images of his in Romanian and some Slavic language literature from the 15th century onwards, including figural depictions like this. But the negative images mostly of the German world, Hungarian and German world, and this has to do with the politics of the time. For instance, Vlad is depicted as a Roman proconsul crucifying Saint Andreas in the 16th century. So for the Protestant world in particular, through Germany and Hungary, he has acquired that kind of evil reputation already in the late 15th century. But not as a vampire, not as a blood-sucking person. The invader was his reputation, as he is also known in the Ottoman sources. Or Vlad as Pontius Pilatus, already in 1463. Vlad himself, Vlad Dracul, the young boy prince, was in the Ottoman lands as a teenager. First in Ottoman court for a bit, but then for more than 2 years in Eger's, town 2 hours to the west of Pitalia, small village town north of Emmet in the mountains, an area inhabited densely with Turkmen tribes in the 15th century, so he had nowhere to run, really, in case one thinks of him as a hostage, and that was part of the function, of course, of the princes of other aristocracies in the Ottoman court, or in the Byzantine court. They were hostages to some degree, so a village environment may look like being free-range chicken, but still, in a certain sense, still satisfying the criterion of confinement. This is Eriger's. Ruins of the castle, the entry gate to the castle. Back to my, from afar, Eriger's again, back to my burial. Okay. It is only because of the lore of vampirism as flourished after Bram Stoker that I mentioned blood. Otherwise, he really would not have a place in this story. But now it's become part of our take on the relationship between vampirism and Ottoman history. But beyond blood, the character known in the 16th century for her blood baths, and here she is depicted by Pablo Picasso, is Erzsébet Báthory, the Hungarian aristocratic lady, whose trial record is simply, I have to say, overwhelming and a very, very sad reading. She was in the end tried and executed. Not executed, sorry, but confined, because she was an aristocrat. She couldn't be. She is known for her blood baths. I think there's something to be written about this still, something that goes beyond the very simple and the obvious. And I really like the way Paloma Picasso plays her with such dignity that enables one to maybe think again. But her legacy otherwise is not easy to uphold or defend. In the late 16th and early 17th century, among the Hungarian aristocracy, not directly touched by the Ottomans, but we might consider it part of that boundary world that I've been speaking about. Again, from the same film, Borowczyk, Vladimir Borowczyk, 1974 or 1975, is the director Polish. Oh well, going in the wrong direction. Okay. There are other kinds of cases about restless undead in Ottoman Turkish sources. Ebu Suud had to deal with one. Perhaps you know. Is Zeynep Aycivi here, what you can? She wrote a terrific article recently on, and really well based in very good sources. I think it was the University where she teaches, a very good article on related matters, cases, beliefs in Ottoman sources, including this very important one concerning Ebu Suud, because in the early 18th century, some peasants from the Edirne area came to the court in Edirne, some Muslim peasants, and said, our Christian neighbors keep bothering us, saying that there is this kind of a phenomenon. And indeed, our own dead are disturbed. The graves are dug up, soil is all messy, there's something happening here, and our Christian neighbors say that we have to stake a horse through their hearts, and we have to do this, cut their heads or burn them, etc., etc. And the judge says, and they say, we heard that Ebu Suud once heard a case like this, and we'd like a decision. And the judge says he couldn't find a decision by Ebu Suud concerning such a happening. And himself says something really wishy-washy, as most authorities do. If it's a really troublesome thing, we may want to do something about it. But for the time being, exhumation is not a good idea. Try to sleep over it. Take aspirin or something. But indeed, Zeynep Aycibin has found the lengthy istifta and fetva by Ebu Suud, where such a case is discussed by Ebu Suud, but Ebu Suud himself answers in the same wishy-washy manner. So if the judge of Edirne had found Ebu Suud's decision, he would not have said anything different. That may be the only disappointing part, otherwise it's terrific research. So there are such instances, a few of them. There is an outbreak in 1833 in Chernobyl that really concerned also Muslims. Muslim Ottomans living in that part of what is now Bulgaria. And that, it turned out, had to do with some Janissary graves, or the graves of some Janissaries who were killed during the annihilation of the Janissary Corps in 1826. But in 1833, there were still anxieties about maybe the corps itself, the Janissary army itself, or simply about individuals from the Janissary army not sufficiently annihilated. So there were concerns, and this took a good deal of time and effort by the judges and the authorities to put down. So there are such instances, but still, there is clearly a boundary between Christian and Muslim Ottomans when it comes to belief concerning vampires, which leads me to questions regarding the role and the ontology. So one big set had to do with the very political context and the geography. Changing boundaries, changing identities, new notions of blood, etc., etc. But looking at what is happening within the Ottoman world among Christians and Muslims living close to one another, but the former embracing the vampire lore in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries in a big way, with the latter not giving much heed to it, except for occasional annoyances and whatnot. That difference leads me to another kind of big question and exploration around that question regarding the role and the ontology of evil. Is how I should pronounce it, and it makes everyone laugh, and that's a good thing, but the ontology of evil and Satan, but also of magic and the like in the metaphysical regimes of Christianity and Islam, respectively. I have several things to say about superstitious beliefs, so-called, and whatnot, but let me just move on to how I want to conclude from this. Several pages later, it is clearly not a difference between levels of rationality or irrationality that one is looking for here, and one should definitely not put matters in those terms. But there are significant differences, ontological differences, in terms of one's attitudes, and I don't mean simply ontology of the as expressed by the elites in intellectual texts and whatnot. I'm really more interested in Evliya Çelebi and lower down, as expressed in popular riddles with notions like potluck, as expressed in tales and masal, etc. And in hagiographies. In fact, namely in the vitae of the special undead of the Muslim sort, namely not saints really in the sense that Peter Brown is studying saints, which have a different kind of status and different paths to sainthood in Christianity, but the Evliya, who are also saintly figures, but have a different path and a different, even the very word, right? The friends of God, they are different types of people. In any case, the distinction between mu'jize and keramet, very difficult to translate into English. The distinction between mu'jize and keramet can be understood as opening space for the supernatural, for miraculous interventions that are short of miracles as such. Namely, there are very, very few miracles, but many, 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 many keramets. Especially with Evliya, they're not mu'jize, but keramets that they perform. And even the word keramet means it is not they performing, it is God's generosity, keramet, kerimlik, that enables them to be in a position that people perceive as if they are performing and engaging in this kind of intercessionary role, which is not really an intercessionary role that is possible for a saint, but not for an Evliya. Are you with me? The distinction between mu'jize and keramet can be understood as opening space for the supernatural, for miraculous interventions that are short of miracles as such. Another important difference between Christianity and Islam, and I know that one shouldn't use these terms as such, but just give me in quotation marks for the moment. Another important difference between Christianity and Islam has to do with the ontology of miracles and of the special deaths, saints or Evliya, likewise with the role of evil and the devil, demons, jinns, and angels. And especially the role of Satan is very interesting here, where Satan is of a lower status. Satan is, for most popular understanding, so in Quran commentaries there are different opinions about the Satan, but even there you find this instance, and in popular understandings he's often one of the jinns. He was first a ruler, a melik, a king of jinns, until the moment, of course, when he was asked to prostrate in front of Adam. And his decision not to do so is well defended by some Sufis, primarily Ibn al-Arabi and his followers, who thus say that Satan, a banned and properly banned thing, being, yes, but at the same time, he was the only one who said, I will not bow down to anyone but you, not even Adam. Even if you order me, I will bow down only to God, kind of way. So, Satan's role and his career and his rank order in the larger scheme of things, of struggling, of struggles between good and evil is different. You're right, found my book title, which I've already given you. In the post-essentialist age, this is coming mostly for my historian friend. In the post-essentialist age, this is what this big set of questions has. This is the direction in which it has led me in thinking about my craft. In the post-essentialist age, which is often more narrowly conceived as post-orientalism in Ottoman studies and related fields, we find it exceedingly difficult to navigate the vast space between specific contextual studies, beliefs and attitudes concerning the evil eye among the peasants of Thrace in the 17th century, type of specific contextual studies. I love it. I should do more of it. But we find it exceedingly difficult to navigate the vast space between these and the generalizing, universalizing approaches, which is traditionally framed, unfortunately, almost always in an essentializing manner. Evil in Islam, or magic according to Islam, type of stuff. This is partly a matter of not minding the difference between generalization and essentialism, which has not been worked out, not even considered seriously, ever since Edward Said and many others burst the game all open regarding essentializing attitudes and their legacy in Orientalism. But, as I said, it should have led us to another line of query where we should be concerned with minding the difference between generalization or universalizing kinds of observations and analyses and essentialism. But we have not done that. And at their peril, do historians stay away from such philosophical questions, in my opinion. I should probably leave you with that. At their peril, do historians stay away from such philosophical questions. That is a Draculian conclusion. I had much more to say, but sorry about the confusion. I can show you more pictures and I can answer your questions if we have time.